This is Audible.
King of Capital, a remarkable rise, fall, and rise again of Steve Schwartzman and Blackstone, by David Carey and John E. Morris, narrated by George K. Wilson. Copyright 2010 by David Carey and John E. Morris. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Crown Business, an imprint of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Chapter 1. The Debutantes. More rumors about his party than about his deals, blared the front page headline in the New York Times in late January 2007. It was a curtain raiser for what was shaping up to be the social event of the season, if not the era. By then the buzz had been building for weeks. Steven Schwartzman, co-founder of the Blackstone Group, the world's largest private equity firm, was about to turn 60 and was planning a fete. The financier's lavish holiday parties were already well known in Manhattan's moneyed circles. One year, Schwartzman and his wife decorated their 24-room, two-floor spread in Park Avenue's toniest apartment building to resemble Schwartzman's favorite spot in Saint-Tropez, near their summer home on the French Riviera. For his birthday, he decided to top that, taking over the Park Avenue Armory, a fortified brick edifice that occupies a full square block amid the metropolis's most expensive addresses. On the night of February 13th, the limousines queued up and the bold-faced names in tuxedos and evening dresses poured out and filed past an encampment of reporters into the hangar-like armory. TV perennial Barbara Walters was there, Donald and Melania Trump, media diva Tina Brown, Cardinal Egan of the Archdiocese of New York, Sir Howard Stringer, the head of Sony, and a few hundred other luminaries, including the chief executives of some of the nation's biggest banks, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, Stanley O'Neill of Merrill Lynch, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, and Jimmy Kane of Bear Stearns. Inside the cavernous armory hung a huge indoor canopy, with a darkened sky of sparkling stars suspended above a grand chandelier, mimicking the living room in Schwartzman's $30 million apartment nearby, the New York Post reported the next day. The decor was copied, the paper observed, even down to a grandfather clock and old master's paintings on the wall. R&B star Patti LaBelle was on hand to sing Happy Birthday. Beneath an immense portrait of the financier, also a replica of one hanging in his apartment, the headliners, singer Rod Stewart and comic Martin Short, strutted and joked into the late hours. Schwartzman had chosen the armory, Short quipped, because it was more intimate than his apartment. Stewart alone was known to charge $1 million for such appearances. The $3 million gala was a self-coronation for the brash new king of a new gilded age, an era when markets were flush and crazy wealth saturated Wall Street, and especially the private equity realm where Schwartzman held sway as the CEO of Blackstone Group. As soon became clear, the birthday affair was merely a warm-up for a more extravagant coming-out bash, Blackstone's initial public offering. By design or by luck, the splash of Schwartzman's party magnified the awe and intrigue when Blackstone revealed its plan to go public 5 weeks later, on March 22nd. No other private equity firm of Blackstone's size or stature had attempted such a feat, and Blackstone's move made official what was already plain to the financial world. Private equity, the business of buying companies with an eye to selling them a few years later at a profit, had moved from the outskirts of the economy to its very center. Blackstone's clout was so great and its prospects so promising that the Chinese government soon came knocking, asking to buy 10% of the company. When Blackstone's shares began trading on June 22nd, they soared from $31 to $38 as investors clamored to own a piece of the business. At the closing price, the company was worth a stunning $38 billion, one-third as much as Goldman Sachs, the undisputed leader among Wall Street investment banks. Going public had laid bare the fantastic profits that Schwartzman's company was throwing off. So astounding and sensitive were those figures that Blackstone had been reluctant to reveal them even to its own bankers, and it was not until a few weeks before the stock was offered to investors that Blackstone disclosed what its executives made. Blackstone had produced $2.3 billion of profits in 2006 for the firm's 60 partners, a staggering $38 million apiece. Schwartzman personally had taken home $398 million that year. That was just pay. The initial public offering, or IPO, yielded a second windfall for Schwartzman and his partners. Of the $7.1 billion Blackstone raised selling 23.6% of the company to public investors and the Chinese government, $4.1 billion went to the Blackstone partners themselves. Schwartzman personally collected $684 million, selling a small fraction of his stake. His remaining shares were worth $9.4 billion, ensuring his place among the richest of the rich. Peter Peterson, Blackstone's 80-year-old semi-retired co-founder, garnered $1.9 billion. The IPO took place amid a financial revolution in which Blackstone and a coterie of competitors were wresting control of corporations around the globe. The private equity, or leveraged buyout industry, was flexing its muscle on a scale not seen since the 1980s. Blackstone, Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts & Company, Carlyle Group, Apollo Global Management, Texas Pacific Group, and a half-dozen others, backed by tens of billions of dollars from pension funds, university endowments, and other big investors, had been inching their way up the corporate ladder, taking over $10 billion companies, then $20 billion, $30 billion, and $40 billion companies. By 2007, private equity was behind one of every five mergers worldwide, and there seemed to be no limit to its ambition. There was even talk that a buyout firm might swallow Home Depot for $100 billion. Private equity now permeated the economy. You couldn't purchase a ticket on Orbitz.com, visit a Madame Tussauds wax museum, or drink an Orangina without lining Blackstone's pockets. If you bought a coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, or a teddy bear at Toys R Us, slept on a Simmons mattress, skimmed the waves on a Sea-Doo jet ski, turned on a Growy designer faucet, or purchased razor blades at a Boots pharmacy in London, some other buyout firm was benefiting. Blackstone alone owned all or part of 51 companies, employing a 500,000 people, and generating $171 billion in sales every year, putting it on a par with the 10th largest corporation in the world. The reach of private equity was all the more astonishing for the fact that these firms had tiny staffs, had long operated in the shadows, seldom speaking to the press or revealing details of their investments. Goldman Sachs had 30,500 employees, and its profits were published every quarter. Blackstone, despite its vast industrial and real estate holdings, had a mere 1,000 employees, and its books were private until it went public. Some of its competitors that controlled multi-billion-dollar companies had only the sketchiest of websites. Remarkably, Blackstone, Kohlberg, Kravis, Carlyle, Apollo, TPG, and most other big private equity houses remained under the control of their founders, who still called the shots internally and ultimately at the companies they owned. Had there been any time since the robber barons of the 19th century, when so much wealth and so many productive assets had come into the hands of so few? Private equity's power on Wall Street had never been greater. Where buyout firms had once been supplicants of the banks they relied on to finance their takeovers, the banks had grown addicted to the torrent of fees the firms were generating, and now bent over backward to oblige the Blackstones of the world. In a telling episode in 2004, the investment arms of Credit Suisse First Boston and J.P. Morgan Chase, two of the world's largest banks, made the mistake of outbidding Blackstone, Kohlberg Kravis, and TPG for an Irish drug maker, Warner Chilcot. Outraged, Kohlberg Kravis co-founder Henry Kravis and TPG's Jim Coulter read the banks the Riot Act. How dare they compete with their biggest clients? The drug takeover went through, but the banks got the message. J.P. Morgan Chase soon shed the private equity subsidiary that had bid on the drug company, and Credit Suisse barred its private equity group from competing for large companies of the sort that Blackstone, TPG, and Kohlberg Kravis target. To some of Blackstone's rivals, the public attention was nothing new. Kohlberg Kravis, known as KKR, had been in the public eye ever since the mid-1980s, when it bought familiar companies like the Safeway supermarket chain and Beatrice Companies, which made Tropicana juices and Sara Lee cakes. KKR came to epitomize that earlier era of frenzied takeovers with its audacious $31.3 billion buyout in 1988 of RJR Nabisco, the tobacco and food giant, after a heated bidding contest. That corporate mud wrestle was immortalized in the best-selling book Barbarians at the Gate and made Henry Kravis, KKR's co-founder, a household name. Carlyle Group, another giant private equity firm, meanwhile, had made waves by hiring former President George H.W. Bush and former British Prime Minister John Major to help it bring in investors. Until Schwarzman's party and Blackstone's IPO shone a light on Blackstone, Schwarzman's firm had been the quiet behemoth of the industry, and perhaps the greatest untold success story of Wall Street. Schwarzman and Blackstone's co-founder Peterson had come late to the game in 1985, more than a decade after KKR and others had honed the art of the leveraged buyout, borrowing money to buy a company with only the company itself as collateral. By 2007, Schwarzman's firm, and it had truly been his firm virtually from the start, had eclipsed its top competitors on every front. It was bigger than KKR and Carlyle, managing $88 billion of investors' money, and had racked up higher returns on its buyout funds than most others. In addition to its mammoth portfolio of corporations, it controlled $100 billion worth of real estate and oversaw $50 billion invested in other firms' hedge funds, investment categories in which its competitors merely dabbled. Alone among top buyout players, Blackstone also had elite teams of bankers who advised other companies on mergers and bankruptcies. Over 22 years, Schwarzman and Peterson had invented a fabulously profitable new form of Wall Street powerhouse, whose array of investment and advisory services and financial standing rivaled those of the biggest investment banks. Along the way, Blackstone had also been the launching pad for other luminaries of the corporate and financial worlds, including Henry Silverman, who, as CEO of Cendant Corporation, became one of corporate America's most acquisitive empire builders, and Lawrence Fink, the founder of BlackRock, Incorporated, a $3.2 trillion debt investment colossus that originally was part of Blackstone before Fink and Schwarzman had a falling out over money. For all the power and wealth private equity firms had amassed, leveraged buyouts, LBOs, or buyouts for short, had always been controversial, a lightning rod for anger over the effects of capitalism. As Blackstone and its peers gobbled up ever bigger companies in 2006 and 2007, all the fears and criticisms that had dogged the buyout business since the 1980s resurfaced. In part, it was guilt by association. The industry had come of age in the heyday of corporate raiders, saber-rattling financiers who launched hostile takeover bids and worked to overthrow managements. Buyout firms rarely made hostile bids, preferring to strike deals with management before buying a company. But in many cases, they swooped in to buy companies that were under siege, and once in control, they often laid off workers and broke companies into pieces, just like the raiders. Thus, they too came to be seen as asset strippers, who attacked companies and feasted on their carcasses, selling off good assets for a quick profit and leaving just the bones weighed down by piles of debt. The backlash against the buyout boom of the 2000s began in Europe, where a German cabinet member publicly branded private equity and hedge funds locusts, and British unions lobbied to rein in these takeovers. By the time the starry canopy was being strung in the Park Avenue Armory for Schwarzman's birthday party, the blowback had come stateside. American unions feared the new wave of LBOs would lead to job losses, and the enormous profits being generated by private equity and hedge funds had caught the eye of Congress. I told him that I thought his party was a very bad idea before he had his party, says Henry Silverman, the former Blackstone partner who went on to head Cendant. Proposals were already circulating to jack up taxes on investment fund managers, Silverman knew, and the party could only fan the political flames. Even the conservative Wall Street Journal fretted about the implications of the extravaganza, saying, "Mr. Schwarzman's birthday party and the swelling private equity fortunes it symbolizes are manifestations of rising inequality. Financiers who celebrate fast fortunes made while workers face stagnant pay and declining job security risk becoming targets for a growing dissent." When on the eve of Blackstone's IPO, 4 months after the party, new tax proposals were announced, they were immediately dubbed the Blackstone tax, and the Journal blamed Schwarzman, saying his garish 60th birthday party this year played into the hands of populists looking for a real-life Gordon Gekko to skewer. Schwarzman's exuberance had put the industry and himself on trial. It was easy to see the sources of the fears. Private equity embodies the capitalist ethos in its purest form, obsessed with making companies more valuable, whether that means growing, shrinking, folding one business and launching another, merging, or moving. It is clear-headed, unsentimental ownership with a vengeance and a deadline. In fact, the acts for which private equity firms are usually indicted, laying off workers, selling assets, and generally shaking up the status quo, are the stock in trade of most corporations today. More workers are likely to lose their jobs in a merger of competitors than they are in an LBO. But because a buyout represents a different form of ownership, and the company is virtually assured of changing hands again in a few years, the process naturally stirs anxieties. The claim that private equity systematically damages companies is just wrong. The buyout business never would have survived if that were true. Few executives would stay on, as they typically do, if they thought the business was marked for demolition. Most important, private equity firms wouldn't be able to sell their companies if they made a habit of gutting them. The public pension funds that are the biggest investors in buyout funds would stop writing checks if they thought private equity was all about job destruction. A growing body of academic research has debunked the strip-and-flip caricature. It turns out, for instance, that the stocks of private equity-owned companies that go public perform better than shares of newly public companies on average, belying the notion that buyouts leave companies hobbled. As for jobs, private equity-owned companies turn out to be about on par with other businesses, cutting fractionally more jobs in the early years after a buyout on average, but adding more jobs than the average company over the longer haul. In theory, the debt they pile on the companies they buy should make them more vulnerable. But the failure rate for companies that have undergone LBOs hasn't differed much from that of similar private and public companies over several decades, and by some measures, it is actually lower. Though the strip-and-flip image persists, the biggest private equity profits typically derive from buying out-of-favor or troubled companies and reviving them, or from expanding businesses. Many of Blackstone's most successful investments have been growth plays. It built a small British amusements operator, Merlin Entertainments, into a major international player, for example, with Legoland toy parks and Madame Tussauds wax museums across two continents. Likewise, it transformed a humdrum German bottle maker, Gerresheimer AG, into a much more profitable manufacturer of sophisticated pharmaceutical packaging. It has also staked startups, including an oil exploration company that found a major new oil field off the coast of West Africa. None of these fit the cliché of the strip and flip. Contrary to the allegation that buyout firms are just out for a quick buck, CEOs of companies like Merlin and Gerresheimer say they were free to take a longer-term approach under private equity owners than they had been able to do when their businesses were owned by public companies that were obsessed with producing steady short-term profits. Notwithstanding the controversy over the new wave of buyouts and the brouhaha over Schwartzman's birthday party, Blackstone succeeded in going public. By then, however, Schwartzman and others at Blackstone were nervous that the markets were heading for a fall. The very day Blackstone's stock started trading, June 22, 2007, there was an ominous sign of what was to come. Bear Stearns, a scrappy investment bank long admired for its trading prowess, announced that it would bail out a hedge fund it managed that had suffered catastrophic losses on mortgage securities. In the months that followed, that debacle reverberated through the financial system. By the autumn, the lending machine that had fueled the private equity boom with hundreds of billions of dollars of cheap debt had seized up. Like shopaholics who hit their credit card limits, private equity firms found their credit refused. Blackstone, which had bought the nation's biggest owner of office towers, Equity Office Properties Trust, that February, for a record $39 billion, and signed a $26 billion takeover agreement for the Hilton Hotels chain in July 2007, would not pull off a deal over $4 billion for the next 2.5 years. Its profits sank so deeply in 2008 that it couldn't pay a dividend at the end of the year. That meant that Schwartzman received no investment profits that year and had to content himself with just his base pay of $350,000, less than a thousandth of what he had taken home 2 years earlier. Blackstone's shares, which had sold for $31 in the IPO, slumped to $3.55 in early 2009, a barometer for the buyout business as a whole. LBOs were not the root cause of the financial crisis, but private equity was caught in the riptide when the markets retreated. Well-known companies that had been acquired at the peak of the market began to collapse under the weight of their new debt as the economy slowed and business dropped off. Household retailer Linens and Things, the mattress maker Simmons, and Reader's Digest, among others. Many more private equity-owned companies that have survived for the moment still face a day of reckoning in 2013 or 2014 when the loans used to buy them come due. Like homeowners who overreached with the help of subprime mortgages and find their home values are underwater, private equity firms are saddled with companies that are worth less than what they owe. If they don't recover their value or renegotiate their loans, there won't be enough collateral to refinance their debt, and they may be sold at a loss or forfeited to their creditors. In the wake of the financial crisis, many wrote off private equity. It has taken its hits and will likely take some more before the economy fully recovers. As in past downturns, there is bound to be a shakeout as investors flee firms that invested rashly at the top of the market. Compared with other parts of the financial system and the stock markets, however, private equity fared well. Indeed, the risks and the leverage of the buyout industry were modest relative to those borne by banks and mortgage companies. A small fraction of private equity-owned companies failed, but they didn't take down other institutions. They required no government bailouts, and their owners didn't melt down. On the contrary, buyout firms were among the first to be called in when the financial system was crumbling. When the U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Bank scrambled to cobble together bailouts of financial institutions such as Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and American International Group in the autumn of 2008, they dialed up Blackstone and others, seeking both money and ideas. Private equity firms were also at the table when the British Treasury and the Bank of England tried to rescue Britain's giant failing savings bank, Northern Rock. Ultimately, the shortfalls at those institutions were too great for even the biggest private funds to remedy. The U.S. government again turned to private equity in 2009 to help fix the American auto industry. As its auto czar, the Obama administration picked Stephen Ratner, the founder of the private equity firm Quadrangle Group, and to help oversee the turnaround of General Motors Corporation, it named David Bonderman, the founder of Texas Pacific Group, and Daniel Ackerson, a top executive of Carlyle Group, to the carmaker's board of directors. The crisis of 2007 to 2009 wasn't the first for private equity. The buyout industry suffered a near-death experience in a similar credit crunch at the end of the 1980s, and was wounded again when the technology and telecommunications bubble burst in the early 2000s. Each time, however, it rebounded, and the surviving firms emerged larger, taking in more money, and targeting new kinds of investments. Coming out of the 2008-09 crisis, the groundwork was in place for another revival. For starters, the industry was sitting on $500 billion of capital, waiting to be invested, a sum not so far short of the $787 billion U.S. government stimulus package of 2009. Blackstone alone had $29 billion on hand to buy companies, real estate, and debt at the end of 2009, at a time when many sellers were still distressed, and that sum would be supplemented several times over with borrowed money. With such mounds of capital, at a time when capital was in short supply, the potential to make profits was huge. Though new fundraising slowed to a trickle in 2008 and 2009, it was poised to pick back up as three of the largest public pension funds in the United States said in late 2009 that they would put even more of their money into private equity funds in the future. The story of Blackstone parallels that of private equity and its transformation from a niche game played by a handful of financial entrepreneurs and upstart firms into an established business of giant institutions backed by billions from public pension funds and other mainstays of the investment world. Since Blackstone's IPO in 2007, KKR has also gone public, and Apollo Global Management, one of their top competitors, has taken steps to do the same, drawing back the veil that enshrouded private equity and cementing its position as a mainstream component of the financial system. A history of Blackstone is also a chronicle of an entrepreneur whose savvy was obscured by the ostentation of his birthday party. From an inauspicious beginning, through fits and starts, some disastrous early investments, and chaotic years when talent came and went, Schwartzman built a major financial institution. In many ways, Blackstone's success reflected his personality, beginning with the presumptuous notion in 1985 that he and Peterson could raise a $1 billion LBO fund when neither had ever led a buyout. But it was more than moxie. For all the egotism on display at the party, Schwartzman from the beginning recruited partners with personalities at least as large as his own, and he was a listener who routinely solicited input from even the most junior employees. In 2002, when the firm was mature, he also recruited his heir in management and handed over substantial power to him. Even his visceral loathing of losing money, to which current and former partners constantly attest, shaped the firm's culture and may have helped it dodge the worst excesses at the height of the buyout boom in 2006 and 2007. Schwartzman and peers such as Henry Kravis represent a new breed of capitalists positioned between the great banks and the corporate conglomerates of an earlier age. Like banks, they inject capital, but unlike banks, they take control of their companies. Like sprawling global corporations, their businesses are diverse and span the world. But in contrast to corporations, their portfolios of businesses change year to year, and each business is managed independently, standing or falling on its own. The impact of these moguls and their firms far exceeds their size, precisely because they are constantly buying and selling, putting their stamp on thousands of businesses while they own them, and influencing the public markets by what they buy and how they remake the companies they acquire. Chapter 2. How Die Magic, Lehman Angst. To Wall Street, the deal was little short of revolutionary. In October 1978, a little-known investment firm, Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, struck an agreement to buy How Dye Industries, an industrial pumps maker, in a $380 million leveraged buyout. $380 million, and a public company no less. There had been small leveraged buyouts of privately held businesses for years, but no one had ever attempted anything that daring. Steve Schwartzman, a 31-year-old investment banker at Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb at the time, burned with curiosity to know how the deal worked. The buyers he saw were putting up little capital of their own and didn't have to pledge any of their own collateral. The only security for the loans came from the company itself. How could they do this? He had to get his hands on the bond prospectus, which would provide a detailed blueprint of the deal's mechanics. Schwartzman, a mergers and acquisitions specialist with a self-assured swagger and a gift for bringing in new deals, had been made a partner at Lehman Brothers that very month. He sensed that something new was afoot, a way to make fantastic profits and a new outlet for his talents, a new calling. I read that prospectus, looked at the capital structure, and realized the returns that could be achieved, he recalled years later. I said to myself, this is a gold mine. It was like a Rosetta Stone for how to do leveraged buyouts. Schwartzman wasn't alone in his epiphany. When How Dye came along, it got everybody's attention, remembers Richard Beatty, a lawyer at Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, who had represented KKR on many of its early deals. Up until that point, people walked around and said, what's an LBO? All of a sudden, this small outfit, three guys, Kohlberg and Kravitz and Roberts, is making an offer for a public company. What's that all about? The financial techniques behind How Dye, which also underlay the private equity boom of the first decade of the 21st century, were first hatched in the back rooms of Wall Street in the late 1950s and 1960s. The concept of the leveraged buyout wasn't the product of highbrow financial science or hocus-pocus. Anyone who has bought and sold a home with a mortgage can grasp the basic principle. Imagine you buy a house for $100,000 in cash and later sell it for $120,000. You've made a 20% profit. But if instead you had made just a $20,000 down payment and taken out a mortgage to cover the rest, the $40,000 you walk away with when you sell after paying off the mortgage would be twice what you invested, a 100% profit before your interest costs. Leveraged buyouts work on the same principle, but while homeowners have to pay their mortgage out of their salaries or other income, in an LBO the business pays for itself after the buyout firm puts down the equity, the down payment. It is the company, not the buyout firm, that borrows the money for a leveraged buyout. And hence, buyout investors look for companies that produce enough cash to cover the interest on the debt needed to buy them, and which also are likely to increase in value. To those outside Wall Street circles, the nearest analogy is an income property, where the rent covers the mortgage, property taxes, and upkeep. What's more, companies that have gone through an LBO enjoy a generous tax break. Like any business, they can deduct the interest on their debt as a business expense. For most companies, interest deductions are a small percentage of earnings. But for a company that has loaded up on debt, the deduction can match or exceed its income, so that the company pays little or no corporate income tax. It amounts to a huge subsidy from the taxpayer for a particular form of corporate finance. By the time Jerome Kohlberg Jr. and his new firm bought How Dye, there was already a handful of similar boutiques that had raised money from investors to pursue LBOs. The How Dye buyout put the financial world on notice that LBO firms were setting their sights higher. The jaw-dropping payoff a few years later from another buyout advertised to a wider world just how lucrative a leveraged buyout could be. Gibson Greeting Cards Incorporated, which published greeting cards and owned the rights to the Garfield the Cat cartoon character, was an unloved subsidiary of RCA Corporation, the parent of the NBC television network, when a buyout shop called Westray bought it in January 1982. Westray, which was co-founded by former Nixon and Ford Treasury Secretary William E. Simon, paid $80 million. But Westray and the card company's management put up just $1 million of that and borrowed the rest. With so little equity, they didn't have much to lose if the company failed, but stood to make many times their money if they sold out at a higher price. 16 months later, after selling off Gibson Greetings real estate, Westray and the management took the company public in a stock offering that valued it at $290 million. Without leverage, another term for debt, they would have made roughly 3.5 times their money. But with the extraordinary ratio of debt in the original deal, Simon and his Westray partner Raymond Chambers each made more than $65 million on their respective $330,000 investments, a 200-fold profit. Their phenomenal gain instantly became legend. Weeks after, New York Magazine and the New York Times were still dissecting Westray's coup. Simon himself called his windfall a stroke of luck. Although Gibson Greeting's operating profits shot up 50% between the buyout and the stock offering, Westray couldn't really claim credit. The improvement was just a function of timing. By early 1983, the economy was coming back after a long recession, giving the company a lift and pushing up the value of stocks. The payoff from Gibson was testament to the brute power of financial leverage to generate mind-boggling profits from small gains in value. At Lehman, Steve Schwarzman looked on at the Gibson IPO in rapt amazement, like everyone else. He couldn't help but pay attention, because he had been RCA's banker and advisor when it sold Gibson to Westray in the first place, and had told RCA the price was too cheap. The Howdye and Gibson deals would mark the beginning of his lasting fascination with leveraged buyouts. The Gibson deal also registered on the radar of Schwarzman's boss, Lehman chairman and chief executive Peter G. Peterson. Virtually from the day he joined Lehman as vice chairman in 1973, Peterson had hoped to coax the firm back into the merchant banking business, the traditional term for a bank investing its own money in buying and building businesses. In decades past, Lehman had been a power in merchant banking, having bought Transworld Airlines in 1934 and having bankrolled the startups of Great Western Financial, a California bank, Litton Industries, a technology and defense firm, and Lynn Broadcasting, which owned a chain of TV stations in the 1950s and 1960s. But by the time Peterson arrived, Lehman was in frail financial health and couldn't risk its own money buying stakes in companies. Much of what investment banks do, despite the term, involves no investing and requires little capital. While commercial and consumer banks take deposits and make loans and mortgages, investment bankers mainly sell services for a fee. They provide financial advice on mergers and acquisitions, or M&A, and help corporations raise money by selling stocks and bonds. They must have some capital to do the latter, because there is some risk they won't be able to sell the securities they've contracted to buy from their clients. But the risk is usually small and for a short period, so they don't tie up capital for long. Of the core components of investment banking, only trading, buying and selling stocks and bonds, requires large amounts of capital. Investment banks trade stocks and bonds not only for their customers, but also for their own account, taking big risks in the process. Rivers of securities flow daily through the trading desks of Wall Street banks. Most of these stakes are liquid, meaning they can be sold quickly and the cash recycled. But if the market drops and the bank can't sell its holdings quickly enough, it can book big losses. Hence, banks need a cushion of capital to keep themselves solvent in down markets. Merchant banking, likewise, is risky and requires large chunks of capital because the bank's investment is usually tied up for years. The rewards can be enormous, but a bank must have capital to spare. When Peterson joined in 1973, Lehman had the most anemic balance sheet of any major investment bank, with less than $20 million of equity. By the 1980s, though, Lehman had regained financial strength and Peterson and Schwartzman began to press the rest of management to consider merchant banking again. They even went so far as to line up a target, Stuart Warner Corporation, a publicly traded maker of speedometers based in Chicago. They proposed that Lehman lead a leveraged buyout of the company. But Lehman's executive committee, which Peterson chaired but didn't control, shot down the plan. Some members worried that clients might view Lehman as a competitor if it started buying companies. "It was a fairly ludicrous argument," Peterson says. "I couldn't believe they turned this down," says Schwartzman. "There was more money to be made in a deal like that than there was in a whole year of earnings for Lehman. About $200 million at the time." The two never gave up on the dream. Schwartzman would invite Dick Beatty, the lawyer for the Kohlberg-Kravis buyout firm, whose law firm was also Lehman's primary outside counsel, to speak to Lehman bankers about the mechanics of buyouts. Lurking in the background was the question, why can't Lehman get into this? Beatty recalls. All around them, banks like Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch were launching their own merchant banking divisions. For the time being, however, Peterson and Schwartzman would watch from the sidelines as the LBO wave set off by Howdy and Gibson Greetings gathered force. They would have to be content plying their trade as M&A bankers, advising companies rather than leading their own investments. Peterson's path to Wall Street was unorthodox. He was no conventional banker. When he joined Lehman, he'd been a business leader and Nixon cabinet member who felt more at home debating economic policy, a consuming passion, than walking a trading floor. A consummate networker, Peterson had a clearly defined role when he came to the firm in 1973, to woo captains of industry as clients. The bank's partners thought his many contacts from years in management and Washington would be invaluable to Lehman. His rise up the corporate ladder had been swift. The son of Greek immigrants who ran a 24-hour coffee shop in the railroad town of Kearney, Nebraska, Peterson graduated summa cum laude from Northwestern University and earned an MBA at night from the University of Chicago. He excelled in the corporate world as a young man, first in marketing. By his mid-twenties, on the strength of his market research work, he was put in charge of the Chicago office of the McCann Erickson Advertising Agency. His first big break came when he was befriended by Charles Percy, a neighbor and tennis partner who ran Bell and Howell, a home movie equipment company in Chicago. At Percy's urging, Peterson joined Bell and Howell as its top marketing executive, and in 1961, at age 34, he was elevated to president. In 1966, after Percy was elected to the U.S. Senate, Peterson took over as CEO. Through an old Chicago contact, George Shultz, later Treasury Secretary and then Secretary of State, Peterson landed a position in early 1971 as an advisor to President Richard Nixon on international economics. Though Peterson had allies in the White House, most notably Henry Kissinger, the powerful national security advisor and future Secretary of State, he wasn't temperamentally or intellectually suited to the brutal intramural fighting and stifling partisan atmosphere of the Nixon White House. He lacked the brawler's gene. At one point, Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, offered Peterson an office in the West Wing of the White House, nearer the president. But the move would have displaced another official, Donald Rumsfeld, later George W. Bush's defense secretary, who fought ferociously to preserve his favored spot. Peterson knew Rumsfeld from Chicago and didn't want to pick a fight or bruise his friend's ego, so he turned down Haldeman's offer. Kissinger later told Peterson that it was the worst mistake he made in Washington. Peterson soon found himself in the crosshairs of another headstrong figure, Treasury Secretary John Connally, the silver-maned, charismatic, former Texas Democratic governor who was riding with President Kennedy when Kennedy was assassinated and took a bullet himself. Connally felt that Peterson's role as an economics advisor intruded on Connally's turf and conspired to squelch his influence. A year after joining the White House staff, Peterson was named Commerce Secretary, which removed him from Connally's bailiwick. In his new post, Peterson pulled off one splashy initiative, supervising talks that yielded a comprehensive trade pact with the Soviets. But he soon fell out of favor with Nixon and Haldeman, the president's steely-eyed, brush-cut enforcer, in part because he loved to hobnob and swap opinions with pillars of the liberal and media establishments, such as Washington Post publisher Katharine Graham, New York Times columnist James Reston, and Robert Kennedy's widow, Ethel. The White House saw Peterson socializing as fraternizing with the enemy. Nixon dumped Peterson after the 1972 presidential race, less than a year after naming him to the cabinet. Before leaving town, Peterson delivered a memorable parting jibe at a dinner party, joking that Haldeman had called him in to take a loyalty test. He flunked, he said, because my calves are so fat that I couldn't click my heels. A tart quip that caused a stir after it turned up in the Washington Post. Peterson soon moved to New York, seeking a more lucrative living. Wooed by several Wall Street banks, he settled on Lehman, drawn to its long history in merchant banking. But 2 months after being recruited as a rainmaker and vice chairman, his role abruptly altered when an internal audit led to the horrifying discovery that the firm's traders were sitting quietly on a multi-million-dollar unrealized loss. Securities on its books were now worth far less than Lehman had paid, and Lehman was teetering on the edge of collapse. A shaken board fired Fred Ehrman, Lehman's chairman, and turned to Peterson, the ex-CEO and cabinet member, to take charge, hoping he could lend his management know-how and his prestige to salvage the bank. The man responsible for the trades that nearly sank the firm was its trading department chief, Louis Glucksman, a portly bond trader known for his combustible temper, who walked the floor with shirt flaps flying, spewing cigar smoke. There were some, particularly on the banking side of the firm, who wanted Glucksman's head over the losses. But Warren Hellman, an investment banker who took over as Lehman's president shortly before Peterson was tapped as chairman and chief executive, thought Lehman needed Glucksman. The trader was the one who understood why Lehman had bought the securities and what went wrong. I argue that the guy who created the mess in the first place was in the best position to fix it, Hellman says. Peterson concurred, believing, he says, that everyone is entitled to one big mistake. Glucksman made good on his second chance, and under Peterson, Lehman rebounded. In 1975, Business Week put Peterson's granite-jawed visage on its cover and heralded his achievement with the headline, "Back from the Brink Comes Lehman Brothers." Despite his role in writing the firm, Peterson never fit easily into Lehman's bare-knuckled culture, particularly not with its traders. His cluelessness about the jargon, if not the substance, of trading and finance amazed his new partners. "He kept calling basis points basing points," says a former high-ranking Lehman banker. A basis point is Wall Street parlance for 1/100th of a percentage point, a fractional difference that can translate into big gains and losses on large trades or loans. Thus, 100 basis points equals 1% of interest. Peterson was appealing in many ways. He was honest and principled, and he could be an engaging conversationalist with a dry, often mordant wit. He wasn't obsessed with money, at least not by Wall Street's fanatical norm. But with his colleagues, he was often aloof, imperious, and even pompous. In the office, he'd expect secretaries, aides, and even fellow partners to pick up after him. Rushing to the elevator on his way to a meeting, he would scribble notes to himself on a pad and toss them over his shoulder, expecting others to swoop down and gather them up for his later perusal. At times he seemed to inhabit his own world. He would arrive at meetings with yellow post-it notes adorning his suit jacket, placed there by his secretary to remind him to attend some charity ball or to call a CEO the next morning. The off-in-the-clouds quality carried over into his years at Blackstone, too. Howard Lipson, a longtime Blackstone partner, remembers seeing Peterson one blustery night sporting a bulky winter hat. Affixed to its crown was a note, "Pete, don't forget your hat." Lipson recalls, too, the terror and helplessness Peterson would express when his secretary stepped away and he was faced with having to answer his own phone. "Patty? Patty?" he'd yowl. Peterson enjoyed the attention and ribbing that his absent-mindedness provoked from others. In his conference room, he would later showcase a plaque from the Council on Foreign Relations, given out of appreciation for, among other things, his unending search for his briefcase. "This was endearing stuff," says Lipson. Some people said he was losing it, but Pete wasn't that old. I think it was a sign he had many things going on in his mind. David Batten, a Blackstone partner in the early 1990s, who admires Peterson, has the same take. "Pete was probably thinking great thoughts," he says, alluding to the fact that Peterson often was preoccupied with big-picture policy issues. During his Lehman years, he was a trustee of the Brookings Institution, a well-known think tank, and occasionally served on ad hoc government advisory committees. Later at Blackstone, he authored several essays and books on U.S. fiscal policy. If he sometimes seemed oblivious to underlings, he was assiduous in cultivating celebrities in the media, the arts, and government. Barbara Walters, David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, Mike Nichols, and Diane Sawyer, among others, and was relentless in his name-dropping. Far outweighing his shortcomings was his feat of managing Lehman through a decade of prosperity. This was no small achievement at an institution racked by vicious rivalries. Since the death in 1969 of its longtime dominant leader, Bobby Lehman, who'd kept a lid on internal clashes, Lehman had devolved into a snake pit. Partners plotted to one-up each other and to capture more bonus money. One Lehman partner was rumored to have coaxed another partner into selling him his stock in a mining company when the first partner knew, which the seller did not, that the company was about to strike a rich new lode. In a case of double-dealing that enraged Peterson when it came to light, a high-ranking partner, James Glanville, urged one of his clients to make a hostile bid for a company that other Lehman brothers were advising on how to defend against hostile bids. The warfare was over the top, even by Wall Street's dog-eat-dog standards. Robert Rubin, a Goldman Sachs partner who went on to be Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration, told Lehman President Hellman that their two firms had equally talented partners. The difference, Rubin said, was that the partners at Goldman understood that their real competition came from beyond the walls of the firm. Lehman's partners seemed to believe that their chief competition came from inside. The Lehman infighting amazed outsiders. "I don't understand why all of you at Lehman Brothers hate each other," Bruce Wasserstein, one of the top investment bankers of the time, once said to Schwartzman and another Lehman partner. "I get along with both of you. If you weren't Lehman Brothers, we'd hate you too." Schwartzman replied. The bitterest schism was between Glucksman's traders and the investment bankers. The traders viewed the bankers as pin-striped and manicured blue bloods. The bankers saw the traders as hard-edged and low-brained.